The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
This is Zero Squared, the Zero Books Podcast. Welcome to Zero Squared. Ashley Frawley is the guest this week. Frawley is a lecturer at Swansea University. Her book, The Semiotics of Happiness, is coming out from Bloomsbury in February. And in this visit, we discuss how happiness was made into a political problem in the UK and how increasing happiness has become a substitute for real progressive politics. It's Wednesday, January 28th, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. Regarding podcasts, I'm hoping to double my workload on that front. I've got a couple of Pop the Left conversations in my archive, as well as a few other archived interviews meant for Diet Soap. And if I can convince Jim Ferris to do it after that long unannounced hiatus, I'd like to carry on with the double feature review. So here's the thing. Zero Squared has its own separate feed over at the Zero Books blog and on iTunes. But if you search for Zero Squared on iTunes, you'll find two feeds. One is the Podomatic Diet Soap feed and has a picture of Philip K. Dick with his cat. And the other shows a painting of Jason Horsley and some guy who looks like Seth Rogen. Actually, the guy who looks like Rogen is me. And that feed is the Zero Books blog feed. So here's what's going to happen. I'm going to phase out the old Diet Soap feed, the one with the picture of Philip K. Dick, by April. That feed will be gone. Most of you are probably subscribed to that feed. That's the Podomatic feed, and for a variety of reasons, I think it's time to leave Podomatic behind. However, while I'm going to phase out the Podomatic feed, I'll be bringing back Diet Soap, Pop the Left, and the Double Feature Review over at DouglasLane.com. So if you want to listen to all of it, to Zero Squared and everything else, you can subscribe to DouglasLane.com through iTunes or some other podcatcher. If you just want to listen to Zero Squared, you can subscribe to the Seth Rogen picture feed on iTunes or in another podcatcher. Again, my own blog, DouglasLane.com, is where you'll find every podcast I do. This feed that you're listening to this through now probably is going to slowly go away. I mean, I'm not going to fade it out really, but its time is limited. Now, while I'm at it, I should mention that there's one other podcast you might look for while you're on iTunes or wherever. Actually, there are two more. One is the Former People podcast that used to be hosted on this feed, the Podomatic feed, and I'm assuming you're listening to that. And it features conversations about movies, literature, philosophy even. The other is Symptomatic Redness. That podcast is new, and it features my co-host from Pop the Left interviewing theorists and writers from the left. The music in this episode includes pieces from Nick Walton. You just heard his piece Martha on the Move in the new intro. Dan Lett's music will be featured. And the YouTube star Christian Graslin performing a trumpet loop version of Pharrell Williams' hit, Happy. You'll also hear a longish excerpt from an American Enterprise talk by Arthur Brooks called The Secret of Happiness. David Harvey will be heard talking about the zero growth economy, and Sam Binkley at the Department of Psychosocial Studies talks about happiness as an enterprise. Finally, Jason Horsley from his Liminal Corner will be heard. And the music you're listening to right now is Mark Hostler from Negative Land, mixing live at the Ghost Print Gallery in Richmond, Virginia. And I'll provide a link to that on Vimeo in the show notes. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Ashley Frawley and I discussing the semiotics of happiness. Ashley Frawley is a lecturer in sociology and social policy at Swansea University in Wales, and in a sense, she is a returning guest, as she appeared on the Diet Soap podcast a year or so back. Frawley's first book, The Semiotics of Happiness, is out from Bloomsbury Publishing, or is coming out soon. Ashley Frawley, welcome to Zero Squared, and thanks for talking to me today.
Thanks very much for having me back.
Yeah. So your book, The Semiotics of Happiness, is coming out, or is it out from Bloomsbury? Which one is it? Is it out already?
Coming out 26th of February.
Okay, great. And it looks beautiful. I like the cover, so congratulations.
Really nice cover. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. So you've written about happiness before. This is sort of a subject that you have done a lot of work on. You got your PhD in happiness studies. That's not what you got your PhD in at all, but I'll just pretend that that's right.
Sociology, yeah, studying social problems and happiness would be an example of that.
Right. So yeah, you didn't go into school and get like a degree in how to be happy. But
no, although a lot of people expect that, and I'm pleased to disappoint them.
Tell me a little bit about how you approach happiness. How is the way you approach happiness different from everybody else who talks about happiness?
There's been a huge amount of interest in happiness over the past decade, or actually 2 decades, but more so in the last 10 years. And a lot of that interest is in sort of finding correlations. So they ask people how happy they are, and then they ask them a bunch of other questions, and then they say, well, you know, people who are religious are happier, and so on. And then that can become quite instrumental. So there's sort of claims making in the news media that will say, you know, scientists have discovered that if you are religious, you'll be happy. So be more religious. You know, a lot of sort of 10-point checklists, you know, get married, don't have kids, be religious, and so on. So there's a lot of that going on. But what I'm interested in is how that would be my dog. Sorry.
Your dog, Marx?
Yes, Marx is always very close to my heart.
Okay.
So my interest is a bit different than that. I'm interested in how within these discourses, happiness is implicitly or explicitly said to be a problem. So it's that, you know, sometimes it's explicitly claimed, you know, people just, they don't know how to be happy. You know, there's one quote in I found that says, you know, all of us want to be happy, but most of us just don't know how to do it. Sometimes they'll say things like, we're hamsters on a treadmill, you know, trying to find happiness, and you know, it's explicitly claimed to be a problem. And then it's sometimes implicitly claimed as well. So I study, instead of sort of joining into that and saying, you know, what the true meaning of happiness ought to be, I study actually the content of those claims. So what do people claim? What do these particular claims makers say is should be the true meaning of happiness? How have we got it wrong? What does that mean to them? And how might the world be better, according to these people, if only we could be brought back to the true meaning of happiness as discovered by science? And I also study why it became powerful and believable that there is a science of happiness, that there can be a science. You know, almost every problem from, you know, underachievement at school to the economic crisis can be solved by realigning ourselves to the correct happiness scripts.
When I hear you talking about your project, I can't help but think about Nietzsche's genealogy of morals. Like, you could write a genealogy of happiness, maybe, only what you're doing is taking a look at the snapshot of the current moment, or maybe the last, how long, 10, 20 years or something.
10 years, yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, you could go back to find out, like, how happiness became as central a concept to people as it is. We like to think that these categories are universal and immutable and unchanging, but they have their own history. Do you cover some of that history at all in your book, or?
Yeah, that's exactly what I do. So a lot of people, what they've done is that, you know, this an idea appears sort of seemingly out of the ether, and the question is, well, why? And so they'll go to, like, the American Declaration of Independence, or, you know, wherever happiness has come up historically, you know, Aristotle and so on, and they'll try to find, you know, well, it started with the Greeks and so on. They construct this kind of philosophical history of happiness as though it kind of emerged organically out of a long period of questioning. Actually, I think it has a far more recent history, and it's really only become it would not become quite as popular as it has been if it hadn't been for, you know, a particular group of experts who discovered this new science. It was a conscious project to make happiness expertise as influential as it is. Positive psychologists in the United States, having discovered this issue, went about creating a space for the expertise, creating a need. They wanted to create happy institutions, you know, happy government, happy education, and so on. So they had to create this idea that there was a deficit, that happiness isn't something that everybody understands, that it requires specialized expertise. And part of the reason why there are, you know, there's X problem is because people are disoriented from the true meaning of happiness. They're seeking happiness in the wrong places. For example, you wouldn't have crime if you understood that things don't make you happy. Sort of, I trace a lot of that history, and I trace it into the UK, how that knowledge was sort of taken ownership of, and what the major claim was that became really successful, which was the sort of paradox of prosperity. That was really the money ticket right there. That was the sort of discovery, quote unquote, of a disconnect between economic growth and happiness, purportedly anyway. So they would compare, they'd bring out these graphs and compare happiness with GDP over time and claim, you know, science has discovered that money doesn't make us happy. Ergo, society should be sort of redirected toward happiness rather than money, as though people pursue money by accident or something.
These ideas seem to be very popular when there's a recession on. You know, don't worry about that you're unemployed. Be happy that the material goods aren't going to make you happy anyway. So don't worry that you can't make your rent, that kind of thing.
Well, interestingly, the claim started to make headway in 2003. That was really when the campaign was, like, sort of officially kicked off in the UK. And it was quite clear that it would become an issue as early as 2007. You know, it was really making waves. And it actually, when the recession hit, there was, you know, that was when I started studying the issue, and I thought, well, you know, it's really going to, all of these claims are going to sound really silly now. It's quite obvious what a conservative elitist discourse it is when people are losing their jobs and you're saying, oh, money doesn't make you happy. You know, you can well imagine an employer saying that to you, and yet it didn't. People were sort of claiming that they had been vindicated. You know, see, the recession hit, and now we can see what truly matters, because everything's been taken away from us.
The idea that happiness should become the center for politics, or like some sort of major political problem to be addressed, that came to the UK or started around 2003. Did it come out of a think tank, or who? How did that come to be?
Actually, it was the first claims makers kind of emerged in the early 1990s in the UK, and these were people associated with think tanks. And I think the LSE, some people at the LSE started to become quite interested in this research that was coming out of the United States at that time. And obviously, it had filtered through to think tanks, but no one really took ownership of it. Nobody really sort of rallied around it. The claims appeared in the media, but then the claims makers to which it was attached kind of, you know, were interested in other things, and it didn't resurface again until about 2002. And that's when Richard Layard, an LSE economist and Labour peer, took it on and made it a conscious campaign in 2003. And in 2004, 2005, he released a book on happiness. It was quite clear at that point that it would be an issue. Interestingly, across the political spectrum, it was widely affirmed, but it was sort of taken up by conservative politicians in the UK. No matter who had sort of taken power, it would have probably been an issue regardless. That's part of the reason why it became so popular, is that for many reasons it appealed to, you know, it appealed across the political spectrum, as these sorts of ideas tend to do.
If I do my job in the next few minutes, I'm going to give you the secret to happiness so that when you go home tonight, you can start living a happier life and you can start sharing it with more people so that they can have a happier life too. There have been hundreds, literally hundreds of studies by economists and social scientists and psychologists about happiness. And basically, they all start by asking the question, who's happy? About a third of Americans say anonymously in accurate surveys that they're very happy people. A little over 50% say they're somewhat happy. And about 10 to 15% of the population is chronically depressed and say they're not very happy. That's actually not the most interesting question. The most interesting question is, what brings happiness? And we know the answer to that too. It's three things: genetics, big life events, and choices. And I'm going to tell you about all three, starting with genetics. Now, a few years ago, social scientists at the University of Minnesota constructed a wonderful database that included 75 pairs of identical twins born between the mid-1930s and the mid-1950s. Now, they were separated at birth and adopted to separate families. At age 40, they were reunited and they were given a personality test. You've got DNA carbon copies. They found that 48% of their happiness is genetic. Now, 48% is genetic, but there are other innate qualities, other innate characteristics that are really important. The most interesting of which is gender. Who's happier, men or women? The answer is women. Most studies, the overwhelming majority of studies, find that women are happier than men and always have been. Married women are happier than married men. Single women are happier than single men. Widowed women are way happier than widowed men. In general, women are happier than men. Okay, so innate differences. Genetics, 48%. The next big one is big life events. This is what you think really drives your happiness. You want to be happy? Go for your goals. You've got these big goals in your life and avoid the bad stuff, right? Now, how much of our life happiness at any particular point comes from the big things, good and bad? The answer is 40%. It's a lot. It seems like you're absolutely right to be chasing the big thing at any particular moment, trying to avoid the big bad thing at any particular moment. But that's wrong. It's 40%, but I'm going to tell you why not to chase it. Two reasons. Number one is we're very bad at getting the things that we're seeking, the big goals that we're seeking. But more importantly, the big things never last. How long will your mood be improved if you get that dream house? 6 months. No matter what you do, it's going to wear off. The big stuff wears off, but the costs of doing these big things last forever. Don't chase the big thing. There's one study that really points this out. It's the most interesting study I've ever seen. It's from 1978, actually. It's an old study, but it's still classic. And it compares two groups of people: quadriplegics and people who win the lottery. Okay, now, what do these people have in common? A huge punctuation to their equilibrium. Boom, bad or good, right? Now, quadriplegics, 6 months after their accidents, on average, their happiness has returned almost to its level prior to their accident. That's what the studies show. Now, not all the way, but almost all the way. See how durable we are? 6 months later, their happiness is something that's innate and has to do with other forces. Okay. That's finding number one. Number two is lottery winners. This one is actually even a little bit more interesting. 6 months after you hit the lottery, the average lottery winner has permanent baseline happiness levels that are slightly below where they were the day before they bought the ticket. Literally, the best thing that can happen to you when you buy a lottery ticket is that you don't win. The truth is, if you want to be happy, don't spend your time obsessing about the great big splash. What you need are habits that will give you the highest likelihood of getting that 40%, that'll drive these events most likely into your life and drive the bad things out of your life in a regular framework, as a regular type of discipline. So what are these lifestyle elements? Lifestyle. And this brings us to the last 12%. Remember, 48% is genetics, 40% is events, you got 12% left. The 12% you have left are under your control. And if you do the things you need to do to get the maximum from the 12%, you're also going to raise the likelihood of getting the 40%, because this gives you the best lifestyle to give you the best lifestyle. So what we need to know now are the things, and there are four of them, that will give you the 12%. And this is where the knowledge is power. This is where you get to walk out of here ready to invest in your happiness portfolio and be a happier person starting tonight. Here's the good news. Simple, available to everybody, and easy to understand. Here are the four.
Faith, family, community, and work.
You made you used a word that I want to kind of pluck out and maybe make a meta question out of here, which is you're talking about claims makers, and that seems like a technical term. What is a claims maker in the context of your book and in the context of your studies there?
Okay, well, I think this kind of connects to sort of where my interest in semiotics comes from, or how I use semiotics. So I'm not a semiotician. I do studies of social problems from a constructionist perspective. And what that means is that I study when a social problem, you know, starts to become talked about in the media or by politicians and so on, instead of sort of taking the problem for granted and, you know, going out and studying how many people are affected and how we can solve this problem, you study instead the claims that people make. So who says it's a problem? What kind of problem do they say that it is? And why are these claims so successful? So when you have a problem like happiness that emerges and becomes, you know, widely affirmed and its claims constantly repeated, then that tells you that there's something interesting going on that needs to be studied, and not necessarily going out and counting how happy people are or whatever, but studying the language that people use to communicate the world, ideas about the world. And for me, the question was why and how happiness became an appealing metaphor to understand social problems today. Because it wasn't just, you know, how happy people were. It was extended to all sorts of different phenomena. People would take its language on and its claims and say, you know, why should you care about my problem? Well, because people are clearly becoming less happy.
So someone who's a claims maker, would that be someone who's a media personality or someone who's releasing scientific studies? Or how do you qualify to be able to make a claim in society?
Well, claims makers can be anyone, really. I mean, you in your living room can be a claims maker to a certain extent. But if you're not in possession of a certain degree of prestige or a platform of some sort, it's highly likely that unlikely that those claims are going to make it any further than your living room. So some claims makers are in possession of you know, direct links to the media or to policymakers and so on. And if you can get you know, if you, activists, for example, they're claims makers. That's typically what we think of. When we think about social problems, we think of like you and me. We see a problem in the world, we organize and we knock on doors and we campaign to bring attention to the problem. But not all problems begin like that, and happiness is an example of that. It really started with the expertise that identified an area of life that could become subject to science, and in order to, you know, for lots of reasons, in order to get funding, and you know, as an expert, you know, even me, if I discover a new issue, you know, that's a big open area I can start publishing in and so on. I can become a recognized expert. I can have people like you talking to me, and that's kind of what happens. And then, you know, you get these in order to make a difference. You want to get your claims into the hands of people who are, you know, connected to policymakers or whatever. If I'm an activist, then I have to do that on the street. But if I'm a member of a think tank, then I've got access to policymakers that's more direct. So there, anybody can be a claims maker, but they differ in terms of their connections, their power, prestige, and so on.
And so, is there a quantitative analysis that you do of a claim like the claims about happiness to judge how effective it is, or are you doing a more institutional analysis like you just mentioned, where you're saying, okay, this is an activist on the street, this is somebody with, you know, ties to institutional power? How do you weight a claim or track how effective or pervasive it is?
Okay. Well, there's two things that I do. The first is tracking the effectiveness of a claim. Tracking the effectiveness of a claims maker. So a claim will emerge, and lots of, you know, that's what I did. Basically, I took a sample of major UK newspapers, and I literally went line by line in a program called InVivo for it's a qualitative data analysis program. And I literally went line by line, and I identified the claims being made about happiness. And every time that I saw a similar claim, then I would count that under that particular claim. So I would sort of encapsulate the claim. So, for example, money doesn't make you happy. That would be a very common claim. And all the variations of that I would sort of quantify underneath it. And those claims that were constantly repeated, I could see as being successful.
What's the claim that took off in 2003 that has been problematized and made into a political category? What are we being sold here? What's the main idea, if you can do that?
I think the key claim around which most happiness claims revolve, they probably would not have gained as much of a foothold as they have, is the what I call the paradox of prosperity. Basically, what they do is they take GDP and then they compare it with happiness. Now, happiness surveys have been done since about the late 1940s, and they're measured differently depending on the study. But for the most part, it's like a 3 or 10 point scale. So you ask people how happy they are. And that's been pretty steady since the late 1940s when they started giving these surveys. But they point out, these claims makers, GDP is constantly rising. So what is all this money for if it doesn't make people happy? That's the key claim. What's funny is that that claim is so powerful and people want to believe it. It's sort of like uniquely real. It rings true in a particular cultural climate to such an extent that people fail to sit back and reflect on the fact that if that's the case, and it is, then absolutely nothing that any politician has done, anything, I mean, talking about women's advances in women's rights and freedoms and so on, absolutely nothing has made anybody happier. So what makes politicians think that anything that they do from now on is? The rather more likely thing is that when you ask people how they're doing, they say, yeah, I'm fine, thanks. You know, people tend to adapt to their circumstances because, you know, it doesn't make much sense in the context of an individual life to, you know, if you have a terrible accident, you're not going to sit there and feel horribly about it forever. Most people actually, you know, eventually they make sense of things and get back to some, you know, normal existence. And by the same token, any kind of great success that you have, you'll be extremely happy for, you know, maybe an hour. And then you have to go back to doing things because that's the nature of time. It progresses and it moves forward.
Yeah, and I love that simple fact that we all know is true. You ask someone how they are, they say, I'm fine, I'm happy enough. And that's going to always be pretty much the case. We could be wearing, you know, we could have jetpacks embedded in our back and be able to fly to the moon every day. And, you know, it would become routine. It wouldn't make us any happier.
Yeah. Then that's a reason for people then to say, so why bother? Why bother having jetpacks? Why bother going to the moon? So this is why I think it's a really, really interesting claim, why it became so powerful. And I think it's because we're no longer very optimistic about the future. And it's become a powerful claim to say there doesn't need to be any more progress. This is the best of all possible worlds. In fact, we've gone too far.
Oh, I love that last bit. We've gone too far. We have
to
go back.
Exactly, yes, yes. And in fact, people will explicitly claim that we've got to go back to an imagined past, a simpler time. Some people, for example, one claim that I studied and traced through newspaper discourses was this idea of Vanuatu being the happiest place in the world. And regardless of the fact that the data was totally skewed and made up and so on, that was only pointed out, you know, once or twice, but the claim itself was repeated, you know, it lost contact to the original so-called research, and it became the truth about the world. Of course, Vanuatu would be the happiest place in the world with, you know, and they would talk about, you know, people with grass skirts and, you know, trading shells and so on. It's this sort of romantic idea of the past, a longing for the past that's purer than the present. And that becomes that claim, that paradox of prosperity becomes the source of all sorts of different claims about, you know, zero growth. equilibrium societies, which I find really funny. I've actually heard David Harvey talk about how we need to think about transitioning to a zero growth economy, which is hilarious for a Marxist to say, because it's actually based on this a fantastical equilibrium idea of capitalism, as though you can have capitalism that's just a sort of simple reproduction.
Is David Harvey saying communism would be a zero growth economy as compared to capitalism, which demands growth, and is out of balance, or is he just talking about fixing capitalism when he says that, I don't know, and I
won't put words into his mouth because I don't know why he says that, and I find it really baffling. I think actually probably why he's saying that is he's being a little bit populist, and he knows that that's a powerful claim, and he's making it. But I think it's a dangerous claim to make, and it feeds into a lot of really regressive sort of currents today. But I think that he's saying that in his mind, he probably thinks that communism would be something like zero growth. But it's really funny because he talks about capitalism has to grow. You can't have a capitalism without growth. So I think that he thinks if you're going to have, you know, zero growth economy, then it's not really capitalism anymore. I think that might be what his logic is. But he's saying capitalism it has to grow, and yet it can't grow. It's running this. There's a central contradiction. Ergo, we have to have a capitalism that doesn't grow.
I try to cut David Harvey some slack or give him the benefit of the doubt, and when he says stupid things, maybe I'm not being so charitable, but I tend to think he's not being just outright cynical, you know, like he doesn't say these things just because they're popular. They're popular because even people like David Harvey will believe them. I think that's my charitable interpretation of the situation.
I also want to give him the benefit of the doubt because I know obviously he is closer to capital than I am, but I find it very strange someone so close to capital can make these kinds of claims. So that's why I think...
Yeah. Well, it says something about the ability to read a text lots of different ways, I suppose, and also what happens to you when you read the same text over and over and over and over and over and over.
The world can't deal with a static economy. It can deal with a zero-growth economy, and that's why I distinguish between development, human development, and growth. I mean, we develop as human beings, and we develop our capacities and powers in all sorts of ways, but it doesn't take necessarily growth in the capitalist sense to do that. So when I say zero growth, I don't mean nothing changes. In fact, I mean human development can go in all sorts of wondrous directions culturally, in terms of, poetry or song or whatever, you know, all kinds of things of that sort seem to me to be possible without necessarily saying the only way you can do that is to have 3% compound growth forever. I think we have to separate growth from human development.
I don't think that he believes in the falling rate of profit. I don't think he thinks that's important. But that's actually, oddly enough, I do talk about that in my book. You would think, a book about happiness, why on earth would I be talking about Andrew Kleiman? But actually, I think that's really important, that this idea that no growth capitalism is some kind of like progressive anti-capitalist slogan, when actually it's clear that you're basically just acquiescing to the most destructive and regressive side of the contradictions of capitalist growth, which is that it has to grow and yet it can't. And so you just say, well, then let's not have it grow. But actually, the progressive dynamism of capitalism is what makes life better. They want to go, they take the side of the contradiction that's actually the worst, which is this tendency to hold back progress. And they say, so let's impose this stasis on society.
You know, I live in the northwest of the United States, in Portland, and here the left, the radical left, really doesn't include Marxism much. And so, you know, in my 20s, I sort of found myself glomming onto or becoming a, I just called myself an anarchist, and reading, you know, even primitivist anarchist journals and things. And in 2008, when the economic crisis hit, and the anarchists were still saying, you know, don't produce anything, you know, unemployment is progress, you know, simplify your life, you know, get off the grid. I was going, wait a minute, this is, all they're doing is supporting austerity. You know, they're just like right in line with the right wing here. You know, self-reliance, grow a farm in your backyard. And then, you know, even the farm in the backyard thing sort of appealed to me, but it, it, all of it seemed to be falling right in line with the right. So, I think these ideas, about zero growth and about getting back to basics and being, leading a simpler life, all of that, it's very attractive to people and even people who consider themselves on the far left.
Exactly. And I think, ironically, it's usually forwarded as an anti-capitalist argument, and yet it is profoundly, it has a sort of profound faith in capitalism implicitly, because what it's saying is that capitalism will be fine, but it's just XYZ that throws it off. So capitalism would be fine, it's just you and your greed and your wanting too much. And everything that capitalism is an equilibrium system and would function as a system of reproduction, but if it weren't for these sort of distorting things.
Yeah, another really scary way that's put forward is when people focus on finance and the banking sector to the exclusion of all else. And that can turn into quite scary kind of right-wing conspiracy mongering type thinking.
Absolutely. So, again, what you're saying is everything would be just fine if it weren't for these bad people and their bad ideas.
Yeah, it basically comes down to the Jewish bankers almost every time. Everything would be fine if it wasn't for them. And that's a very, you know, that doesn't have a good track record, that ideology.
And also, you know, it exists in that sort of quasi-fascist kind of way, but it's also even on the sort of academic left, you see this kind of idea perpetuated, and that's through talking about neoliberalism as the source of all problems, and you know, this idea that you know, implicit in this is that everything would be fine if it weren't for these bad ideas that appeared, you know, some decades ago and have yet to release their grip, rather than understanding why neoliberalism was a necessary approach to certain deeper trends. But that's also because we've lost, at least, you know, in academia, we've lost that vocabulary to critique capitalism at a deeper level. And it's almost like it's almost become kind of like a cliche, you know, what's the, you know, you want to find out what's the reason behind some idea that you don't like or some policy you don't like. The answer is always neoliberalism. Oh, it's neoliberal and so on. Why, you know, what's underneath that? Why is that necessary?
Bring it back to the subject of your book. If you ask the question, why am I not absolutely happy? The answer becomes, oh, because the bankers are making me into just a consumer. And if I simplified my life, I could be orgasmically happy all the time. That's kind of the ideology behind the...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So positive psychology is a new development within the field of psychology whose aim is to make people happier with the aid of the most current psychological methods known to the field. Two important figures are responsible for the founding of this new field. One is Martin Seligman, and the other is Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. They describe the aims of this goal as the surpassing of the traditional preoccupation of the psychological professions with negative states, depression, neurosis, psychosis, discomforts of various kinds, and focusing, it said, on the positive conditions, such as happiness, emotional well-being, and a term which they describe as flourishing, emotional flourishing. Thus, positive psychology maps out, with the same measures of scientific precision applied to mental pathologies, the psychological states identified with happiness and well-being itself. So here we see traditional psychology being primarily concerned with the negative, all the bad things, sometimes described as psychology as usual. Positive psychology, moving beyond that to the positive. How can we actively construct happiness? Since the publication in 2007 of Seligman's best-selling work, Authentic Happiness, Using the New Positive Psychology to Realize Your Potential for Lasting Fulfillment, the new discourse on happiness has developed into a dynamic cultural phenomenon, earning repute both within academic psychology and in a variety of applied fields, which range from business to public policy, as well as the heady world of self-help publishing. Today, more than a decade after the foundation of positive psychology, the field has consolidated its hold on the more traditional venues of academic psychology. Perhaps most impressive, however, is the success of positive psychology as a popular cultural and media phenomenon. In 2005, Time magazine declared positive psychology the new science of happiness and created tremendous buzz, tremendous excitement around the potentials of this new science, which could create emotional well-being in individuals. In recent years, titles brandishing the scientific credential of positive psychology have tried to lay claim to the term happiness itself and edge out those kind of mushier, less objective, less scientifically credentialed offerings of self-help and New Age gurus. A Google search of happiness and positive psychology yields a thriving cottage industry of happiness coaches, consultants, and business visionaries. There's a positive psychology iPhone app, which asks you very, very simple questions, and you're supposed to do it every day. Carefully answer the statement, I feel like a failure, I don't feel like a winner, I feel like I have succeeded, da-da-da-da, and all the way up, and you save and you continue. And you can wind up, in this case, I did this actually during February in Boston, which is a very dreary place, and I'm glad I hit 26, actually. I didn't even feel that. But 26% happy, and if you see, you can chart your happiness as the weather declines and so on. Okay. The core elements of positive psychology are relatively easy to grasp, owing to the field's penchant for the popular psychology genre.
Okay, so I wanted to ask you a silly question, which is, how does a Pharrell Williams song fit into all this?
I was in Greece when I was writing bits of this, and whenever I was just fed up with it, that damn song would come on the radio, and I just wanted to throw the radio out the window.
Well, I mean, look at what does he say? He says, it might seem crazy what I'm about to say, but I'm a hot air balloon that could go to space. With air like, I don't care about the way. Why is that, you ask? Well, it's because I'm happy.
Yeah, the interesting thing about that song is that, I haven't really like sat down and looked at the lyrics, but the few moments when I've managed to force myself to listen to small bits of it, there isn't any particular thing that seems to be making him happy. And like, I think that's why the people that I talk to who don't like that song, it seems really, well, first of all, a lot of people who study happiness will complain that it's shallow. It seems shallow, and they need to say, no, this is a serious subject, and so on. But I think the reason why it can seem shallow is that a love song, for example, can also seem shallow if you're just saying love, love, love over and over again, and there isn't any content to the situation. You don't put in a relationship that's causing you these feelings of love. There are lots of horrible love songs that are like that, and lots of really good ones at the same time that talk about the relationships that bring, you know, that make that emotion meaningful. But this song is just purely about an emotion, and it's like a bazillion different metaphors for that particular emotion, which is why I think it's annoying.
Well, you can't define it, because it's utopia. Once you start to define it, there's got to be something that it isn't. And this is supposed to be everything, happiness.
Well, so. I think actually why it's difficult to define is because it acts as a linguistic metaphor for that which is good. So it's a reference. So when you're saying that something makes you happy, or something is happiness, or should cause happiness, you're rhetorically aligning that thing with what is good. actually, historically, if you look at discourses, you know, when happiness was used just sort of in everyday sort of print discussions, it was used in that kind of perfunctory way as a sort of floating signifier that, you know, not a lot of meaning was meant to be placed in that word itself as sort of, you know, a particular thing, but actually it referred to the goodness of the things that, you know, the prime focus of whatever the discussion was about. So, for example, there's one article I looked at that talked about investment in pensions as an investment in public happiness. Now, no one was saying, you know, we're going to go out with clipboards and measure whether or not pensioners are happy in 30 years. They were saying it will be good to do this. That's what they were saying. And I think to a certain extent, happiness still functions that way, whether or not a lot of these experts realize it. When they're saying, you know, X is associated with happiness and they pick whatever, what they're really saying is that it's good. And I think a lot of people, when they talk about, I will be happy when, I don't think they necessarily mean they're going to be jumping for joy. And if you give them a clipboard, they'll write, I was a 7 before and now I'm a 10. They mean it will be good. I will be happy when I have a family. It will be good for me to have a family. Nobody thinks that they're going to be smiling ear to ear or whatever. It's a signifier of what is good.
I do think that people believe when you're setting after a goal, they don't believe that they will be a 10 instead of a 7 or they'll be quantifiably happier, but that they will be better. They will become good to themselves. And that doesn't ever really happen for people, I don't think. Or for at least, you know, I hate to say it, but I don't think that happens.
Yeah, because
for
then
people.
You move the goalposts, right? But then this again is problematized in discourses. So it's like they call it the hedonic treadmill. So they like, why bother moving? You know, you're not going to be any happier. You're just going to move the goalposts. But that's again, it's problematizing something that, you know, is just for most people a fact of life. When I was 16 and I got my first job, making a $100 paycheck was pretty awesome to me. It's not going to be awesome for me anymore. I've moved the goalposts. But that's the nature of life. But what these happiness psychologists are doing is they're problematizing my raised expectations. And again, I think the deeper thing that I'm interested in, and rather than sort of making these sweeping judgments about how people view happiness in their everyday lives, I think that moves a little bit beyond what I really want to talk about. What I think is the deeper message that's being forwarded is that looking forward to the future is bad. That the future is bad. That we have to maintain the present. That the ultimate goal of everything is stasis. It's this fear of change, a critique of change as detrimental and damaging, and this desire, this cultural desire to maintain the present. You know, the past was bad, but the future is much worse.
Right, right, yeah. Then, yeah, and we could, I'm thinking about that T.J. Clark essay, but I'm going to skip that. But in your book, you mentioned, if I'm remembering correctly here, that one reason why happiness became a new category for people to fixate on was because religion was declining or had declined. That's real early in your book. Did you mention that?
Yes, not just religion, but just any kind of big, broad ideologies that at least some large section of the public might hold on to in common.
So it came down to, rather than having a collective project that would lend meaning to a culture's life, a people's life, it all came down to the individual. And that all that was left was happiness at that point, when you're talking about individual by individual meaning rather than collective meaning.
That's something that Christopher Lash talked about, I think in the 70s. You know, right. When all the big ideas are gone, there's nothing left but a manipulable sense of well-being. So what do? You get in touch with yourself, you do yoga and whatever. And these sorts of things, fine, harmless in themselves, elevated to a political, I can't remember exactly what the quote is, but elevated to a political agenda signify the death of politics or the loss of politics. And that's really, it's really the triumph of the therapeutic. Happiness is a signifier of the triumph of the therapeutic, or a key signifier therein. But there are lots of them. You know, there's self-esteem, happiness. There'll be another one after happiness goes. It's on its way out now. There'll be another one that comes up. Love, something like that, will be the next big thing that everyone's talking about as the cause and solution to all of life's problems. If only we could teach people the true meaning of love, then we wouldn't have war. Completely lost any kind of deeper way, any kind of vocabulary for making sense of the world. And so these sort of emotional signifiers are all that we have left.
There is no form of entertainment which isn't a form of instruction, and there is no form of instruction that is not carrying an ideology. Therefore, there is no way to absorb or imbibe entertainment without imbibing the values and the ideology that those values make up, along with the entertainment. It's very much like the Trojan horse. Culture is a Trojan horse. Hollywood is a delivery device for state propaganda. It's not only that. There are larger levels or larger lenses through which to look at this. But I think we have to start with that one, which is big enough for most people. Marshall McLuhan said that advertising is the only really original art form of the 20th century. Not quoting directly there, roughly. If we think of advertising as the art of persuasion, illegitimate persuasion even, then he was right, and he didn't know the half of it. Because essentially it became the overriding art form, as in all the other art forms. Once advertising became an art, the science of persuasion, legitimate persuasion, once that became possible, then any art form, any media that didn't employ it would be left in the dirt. It wouldn't be able to compete with those that did. So essentially advertising became the primary means for artistic media. Movie watching is a curious addiction, because what movies provide, like heroin, is a desire-free state. Of course, the movie in question, like heroin, has to be a good movie, uncut with talcum powder or milk sugar. Otherwise, desire will rapidly creep back in, even if it's only the desire to watch a different movie. Freedom from desire is freedom from fear. Freedom from identity is what movies provide, an all too brief spell. But since they don't make it better in the long run, they don't help me to clear out the junk of my past, they probably only make it worse. And this is, I think, the fundamental appeal of movies, is that they allow us to be somebody else. We experience this desire-free state by identifying with characters on the screen, and by extension the values that those characters are embodying, serving, even in terms of the narrative. I think that this is how ideologies get installed in us, through movies particularly. I would imagine it works also in other realms, religion and politics and so on, school, education. I think movies are particularly seductive because they are a form of entertainment, so they do sweep us away in such a way that we're not aware of any other motive for it. We're trained to think of them just as simple entertainment, and so when we get swept away, all we're really deducing from that is that it's a good movie. So if movies give us temporary respite from identity and from desire, but in the process, if they instill in us new forms of desire or intensify desires that are already being instilled in us by the culture, the desire to be powerful, for example, to be a somebody, to be successful, to be strong, to stand up to injustice, to make change, to be a somebody. So, and this is how identification works, this is why movies depend on movie stars to be successful, to get greenlit. Because the primary goal of movies, which is to inspire us or coerce us to identify with the narrative, it depends on having actors who will not just embody the character but embody the qualities we want to identify with, which is success. So movie stars are by definition successful. We want to identify with them regardless of the kind of character that they play. The irony of this, of course, is that movie stars are successful by pretending to be somebody else. They're liminal beings in that regard. They're neither themselves nor the characters they play, but some weird intermediary state between the two. And that is very easy for us to identify with. We as audience members are liminal beings also. We're neither the characters on the screen nor, in a sense, ourselves when we're watching the movie, because we're just passively receiving the narrative from outside of ourselves, letting it possess us. So there's this kind of mutual complicity and liminality there.
Well, not today, maybe tomorrow?
Isn't it rainy tomorrow?
Blah.
Even the movie stars that we're emulating and worshipping and whose values we're aspiring to embody, they also want to be somebody else, like Woody Allen's famous line that his only regret that he wasn't born somebody else. It could be the most sincere expression of a whole, of an age, really, the age of celebrity culture. I'm a bit leery or wary of mentioning or quoting Woody Allen in any context at this point, but in a way that underlines my, not my point, but another point, really, which is that movie stars are not what they seem. They may make a fortune and become incredibly powerful social movers by playing underdogs, as Woody Allen did. In a way, they get to have their cake and eat it. Certainly, they get to be these very powerful social entities while at the same time having the adoration of the masses in the way that politicians don't, because they embody or they reflect the dreams, the projections of the masses by playing characters that the masses can identify with. And the audience also, we get to have our cake and eat it because we get to identify with the character who is like us on the screen, while at the same time, secretly or not so secretly, we're identifying with the movie star who plays him or her, who, as I say, is openly dreaming of being somebody else too. But they've found a way to actually pretend to be somebody else, that is to say, to negate their own authentic self as a profession and to become the ultimate somebody by being, like Zelig, the ultimate nobody. That sounds very zen. I'm going to end on that. That was very much a spiel. I didn't even know where it was coming from. Whether it made sense or not, I will let my Stalin editor decide. Oh, I should plug myself, because I so want to be a somebody. MovieAutist.com, Auticulture.com, Jason Horsley, 25th of January, 2015.
Bye.